everything. She simply stared out the viewport at the vistas of molten Nicolon and its fiery sun. She imagined that she could feel the heat, even through half a meter of transparasteel, burning her defenses away. Finally, she felt a hand on her shoulder. She turned to find none other than Commodore Vita standing behind her.
"I thought I'd better come myself to give you the news," he said. "I'm sorry, Captain, but we're standing you down from the Salvation. The demotion is only temporary, while Senator Mothma goes over the case again, and may not last longer than a day or two. Both of you just need an opportunity to cool down. I hope you understand."
She bit down on her disappointment and the urge to argue. Vetus was going out of his way to explain, something he was under no compunction to do.
"Yes, sir. I understand."
"In the meantime, the princess sent you this,"
he added, patting the head of a blue and white astromech droid she hadn't even noticed at his side.
"She hopes that you will put it to good use."
"I'm sorry, sir."
"She understands that you have a faulty droid in your possession. He's being brought from the Salvation as we speak. The corporal will show you to a maintenance suite that has been put at your disposal. You have the time to see to your droid now, and I suggest you don't waste it."
With that, he left her. Juno watched him go, frowning. What did he care about her droid? What did the princess?
"Is it possible," she asked herself, "that I'm dreaming all this?"
The R2 unit burbled something electronic she couldn't understand. It didn't help.
"This way,"
said the perky corporal, reappearing at her side.
"After you,"
Juno told her. The R2 trundled patiently in their wake. Proxy was already waiting for her when she arrived, stretched out on an examination table in a private workshop. His familiar skeletal form was dented and scarred by countless rough patch jobs and the occasional field welding. His yellow eyes were extinguished now, as they had been for months. Just seeing him made her uncomfortable, for reasons she found difficult to express, even to herself. Surely she should be over it all by now.
"Let's fire him up," she told the R2 unit when the corporal had gone, "and see what you can do."
She reached a hand into Proxy's innards to reactivate his power supply, but instead of moving to help her, the R2 unit rolled back a step and projected a hologram onto the floor between them.
"I apologize for the deception, Juno,"
a miniature version of Princess Leia told her. The recording had been taken not long ago. She was still wearing the clothes she had worn to Juno's interview. Only the background had changed.
"I hope you'll forgive me for not standing up for you before. I cannot speak freely, even when I know what my father would have me say. While he's in hiding, it's my job to keep the Alliance together. And I know you appreciate how hard a job that is. Mon Mothma is my friend and teacher. I would not defy her openly, when we all know that what she says is at least in part correct. We must proceed cautiously, but at the same time we must act decisively. No agreement is possible, so it's better that she doesn't know what you're about to do."
Juno squatted down in front of the hologram, feeling a faint revival of hope within her.
"R2-D2 here will do what he can for your droid. You'll need help convincing the Mon Calamari and the Quarren to join our cause, even with Akbar on your side. I've arranged for one agent of the Organa household to meet you in Proxy at Dax Moon and coordinate the rendezvous, but that's all the help I can spare you, I'm afraid. From here on, it's up to you."
She smiled.
"I'd wish you good luck, Juno, but I'm hoping you won't need it."
With that, the recording fizzled out, looped back to the beginning, and started to play itself again.
"That's enough,"
Juno told the R2 unit. She settled back into her haunches to think. Leia wanted her to bring the Mon Calamari to the Alliance table without Mon Mothma learning of it. did Garmbel Iblis know? Probably not, since he was elsewhere in the galaxy, and even private transmissions could be overheard. But Commodore Vetus had to be part of the scheme. It was he who decided how officers in his attack group were disciplined. In Juno's case, by relieving her of her command. And he, who had delivered the droid to her. He was definitely a conspirator in the plan to give Juno not just the means to complete this mission, but the opportunity. Yet without the salvation behind her, she wondered, what could she possibly achieve in the fight against the Empire? She snorted at her own cowardice. What couldn't she achieve without that great lumbering mass of responsibility hanging over her head? Coda had been a master of this kind of work, employing small teams of hand-picked militia in fast strikes to achieve well-defined outcomes. If he could do it, so could she.
"Hello, Juno," said a familiar voice from the table. "I can't tell you how relieved I am. Relieved to see you again." She braced herself to look at Proxy, but the sight still came as a shock. Sitting on the table was a perfect replica of him, of Starkiller, of the man she had loved who was now stone dead, but recreated down to the last detail by the droid that had served him. R2-D2, was it? The droid beeped happily. "See what you can do to fix his faulty holographic circuits," she ordered. "His primary programming is gone too, but I can live with that if you can fix the other. It's been getting worse ever since we found him on Corellia." "Thank you," said the perfect image of Starkiller as the R2 unit moved in. He was wearing the same Jedi uniform the real one had worn during the attack on the Death Star. "I'm aware that I cause you distress. It would please me to serve you again, as my master wished." "Stop," she said, raising a hand and turning away. "Just stop." "Yes, Captain Clips." She held her breath until the little droid went to work, and the crackling of an electric arc banished all possibility of conversation. Chapter 3. Present day. Cato Nymoidia's orbital lanes buzzed with nervous activity. A strong Imperial presence vied with a steady flow of freighters to and fro, many of them escorted by TIE fighter or mercenary squadrons. Even from orbit, Starkiller could see evidence of recent military activity, particularly a deep black scorch mark near one of the planet's famous hanging cities. Some kind of heavy munitions had been in play, although probably not nuclear. There was no sign of evacuation of the nearby populace. Starkiller had never had cause to come to this world before, not during his brief period of recruitment for the nascent rebellion, nor during his first apprenticeship to Darth Vader, when his role had been as much assassin as apprentice. Indeed, surviving and defeating those who challenged his former master had been as important a part of his former self's training as anything on the Executor. Those challengers had been his first real targets, apart from proxy droids. Only when he had proven himself capable had the Dark Lord deemed him worthy of combat with him. Starkiller orbited Cato Nymoidia once, safe in Darth Vader's TIE fighter, and simply stared. He had been down a pit on Kamino for 13 days, and in Vader's clutches for what felt like a lifetime. He had forgotten what sunlight looked like. He had forgotten what it felt like to be a free agent. There was so much he had forgotten, and so much that was slowly coming back to him. Juno. She felt strangely close, even though he had no reason to suspect that she was nearby. In his mind, she was coming clearer with every hour. He couldn't believe that she had almost slipped away. Oh, he understood it well enough. He knew all about Darth Vader's mind games and the power of the dark side.
He had lived with it, and prospered from that too, in his original lifetime. He could exert his will over others in order to get what he wanted, but he didn't doubt that. Didn't doubt that Vader had almost succeeded in driving every last memory of the woman Starkiller had loved from his mind. Now, she was back, and it seemed incomprehensible to him that she had ever gone away. Even when he had lost everything in his former life, when every last hope of victory had been taken from him, he had thought of her. His demise had meant nothing compared with the knowledge that she had escaped safely from the Emperor's deadly space station. Then, death, and revival, and forgetting, powerlessness, and fear. But now he was back. Nothing could stand between him and Juno, not for long anyway. With her ahead of him, leading him on, he felt stronger than ever. From the depths of his memory, he heard the murdered Jedi Master Shakti. "You could be so much more." Then his own voice, speaking not to her but to Juno, in another place, another time. "The Force is stronger than anything we can imagine. We're the ones who limit it, not the other way around." Starkiller breathed deeply and closed his eyes. His mind was just one speck in the endlessly shifting sea that was the galaxy. He felt the eddies and currents of the combined life force of every living thing sway through him, and with only a small effort, he detached himself from himself and joined that flow, seeking the one he needed. The roar of a crowd filled his mind. Movement scattered his mental vision, made it hard to make out anything specific. Was that fluttering wings or banners? He couldn't quite tell. Figures that might have been beings glowed blue all around him. Above him hung a giant eye, staring downward. "Are you still with me, Coda?" His vision shifted, became red-tinged, deeply red, as though someone had cut the throat of a giant beast and drained it onto the ground. Something snarled, something roared. There was a flurry of limbs, a wild rush of violent intent. "It's all in your mind, boy," said Coda from his memory. Green light flashed. More blood. Severed limbs fell onto the dirt. The crowd roared. General Rom Coda, leaning back on his heels, breathing heavily, surrounded by a ring of corpses. How long had he been fighting now? 6 days? 7? Fatigue was taking its toll. With every wave, he came closer to making a mistake. And when that happened, it would all finally be over. Starkiller opened his eyes. His lips were pressed into a thin line. "Hold on, old man," he whispered, and brought Darth Vader's TIE fighter smoothly out of orbit. The Imperial forces on Caeton Imordia were clustered around one particular bridge city, suspended over a deep sinkhole that led an unfathomable distance into the planet's crust. Why? Perhaps the local dictator liked to throw his prisoners off the edge so they would serve as examples to their friends. Starkiller didn't care. He wasn't going over the edge. He was coming for just one thing: to rescue General Coda, or, at the very least, learn from him where Juno could be found. Nothing else mattered. Not even the endless vistas of space, or the light of an unfamiliar sun. His ship had been noticed the very moment he'd arrived. On descent, it was immediately joined by a full escort of TIE fighters, acting on the assumption that the being piloting it was Darth Vader, the Emperor's chief enforcer, as its transponder code suggested. Starkiller didn't disabuse them of this notion. Anything that eased the path ahead was fine by him. The TIEs broadcast warnings and cleared a landing bay ahead of him, and then peeled off to resume their regular duties. He brought his stolen starfighter safely to a halt on the swaying platform, conscious but not caring that there was nothing between him and the sinkhole below but several layers of metal. It might intimidate others, but it made no difference to him. Several skiffs parked on the platform had scattered as he approached the waiting hangar. A squadron of stormtroopers stood to attention in two perfectly parallel lines, their weapons honorific, not threatening. If Vader had guessed that he was coming here, word hadn't yet reached the local potentate. That was good. He landed, shut down the engines with smooth efficiency, and climbed out of the pilot seat. The hatch opened with a hiss. His booted feet hit the hot metal of the landing deck with a ringing boom. A new person had arrived. A balding man, dressed in heavy robes, with Imperial insignia mixed with Nymordian trappings, standing at the head of the double line of troopers. He looked nervous, but that soon turned to puzzlement as Starkiller strode into view. Starkiller realized only then how he must have looked. The flight suit he wore was torn and filthy, thanks to weeks in Vader's pit and ceaseless combat training. In the former Starkiller's life, he'd had the art of stealth and invisibility drummed into him, but he was in too much of a hurry now to worry about that.
"I was expecting Lord Vader," said the robed man, the potentate himself, judging by the air of authority he thought he radiated.
Starkiller recognized his voice. He had heard it in a vision on Kamino saying, "Try the Corellian Razor Hounds." This was time for neither small talk nor mystical catch-ups.
"The Jedi," Starkiller said. "Where is he?"
"He's alive, for the moment."
"I asked where he is."
The robed man straightened, sensing a challenge.
"What are the security codes for this sector?"
Starkiller ignored the question and kept walking between the double lines of stormtroopers.
"The security codes!"
With a rattle of plastoid, the stormtroopers shifted their weapons to point at him. The robed man drew a blaster and aimed with a steady hand. The Imperial stood between Starkiller and Coda. With a tightening of his lips that might have been a smile, Starkiller ignited his lightsabers.
"Kill him!"
ordered the potentate, snapping off two precise shots. Starkiller deflected both of them harmlessly into the floor. The troopers opened fire on both sides, and he turned to deflect the incoming blaster bolts. In the corner of his eye, he saw the potentate heading for the turbo lift. Not so fast, he thought, reaching out to pull the man back. The lift doors opened, and a pair of heavily armed troopers emerged, already firing. Pressed on three sides, Starkiller forced himself to forget about the potentate and concentrate on the immediate threats. Blaster bolts ricocheted wildly around him, deflected by his double blades and hitting neck joints, visors, and breathing systems. Missiles from the newly arrived pair peppered him, filling the air with smoke. His force shield kept the worst of their effects at bay, and he pressed forward, reaching out to telekinetically crush the missile launchers and trigger the remaining charges. With a bright flash and a deafening boom, the last of his obstacles disappeared. A powerful excitement thrilled through him. For the first time in the middle of combat, it came to him that he was truly alive. He wasn't a shadow lurking in a hole somewhere, dreaming of being. The Force was with him, and he was free. He was free, and he had a mission. The potentate was long gone. Starkiller tore his way into the turbolift shaft, bypassing security codes by means of sheer power, and rode to the upper levels. The transparasteel walls revealed the hanging city in all its glory, curving away from him to his left and right. But he wasn't interested in taking in the sights. He studied the buildings looking only for tactical information. The vision of Coda had hinted at an open space and a large gathering of people. The scans he had taken from orbit hadn't shown any place like that. The largest structure in the city was the Imperial Barracks, a circular building at its direct center. When the turbo lift reached the summit and the doors opened on the city, he was greeted by the distant roaring of a crowd. He stepped out and listened closely. The roar was coming from the barracks. He set off on foot, running swiftly through the streets. They were only sparsely populated, with the occasional green-skinned Nymoidian scuttling by, determinedly staying out of his way. He could hear no audible alarms, but had no doubt that they were ringing somewhere. That suspicion was confirmed at the sound of booted feet stamping along the streets behind him. He shifted to an aerial route, climbing to the top of the nearest building and leaping from it to the next in line. That way, he could avoid the roads entirely. He felt weightless as he swung from handhold to handhold with a force thrilling through him like the purest oxygen. The city's lower levels clustered around the bases of several broad circular towers connected by looping tram lines, and it was a simple matter to travel from one to the other into the city's heart, as light as air itself. When the Imperial security forces got wise to his plan and activated gun emplacements in the city's upper levels, things became considerably more interesting. Dodging weapons fire from tram track to building and back again, Starkiller felt a familiar calm creeping over him. It was a calm born not of peace or tranquility, but of violence and anger. Countless hours of meditating on the dark side, fueling the negative energies that Darth Vader encouraged him to embrace, made this kind of combat trance almost second nature to him. Fighting people was harder than fighting proxy droids, but there was a greater pleasure in it too, more of a challenge. A warrior who fought only rationally and without emotion fought exactly like a droid. People were stranger, more unpredictable, and therefore fundamentally more difficult to defeat. He swung his lightsabers as though in slow motion. He watched reflected energy bolts creep between him and his targets with a laziness that belied their deadly power. Once, in his other life, he had been sent to Ragna III to quell an uprising of the hostile Uzem. Barely 12 years old, he had been betrayed by the weapons his own master had given him. All had failed on landing, along with his starship, leaving him armed only with the Force and his wits. Single-handedly, he had fought to the nearest Imperial installation and escaped off-world, expecting either rebuke for failing his mission or praise for having survived. He had received neither, and the memory of his puzzlement came to him now, as clear as the crystal in the heart of his first lightsaber. The lesson hadn't been to survive, he'd eventually come to understand. It had been to come to terms with his own destructive power. In his wake, he'd left dozens of Uzem injured or dead, until it had been forced upon him. He'd never known just what he was capable of, and just how little praise he needed to keep on doing it. Later in that other life, Starkiller had raged against all the deaths he'd caused in the service of his Dark Master. Starkiller had been Darth Vader's weapon, aimed squarely at the Emperor's enemies, and nothing he'd sworn would stand in his way. Only at the last minute had he swerved aside, deflected by Juno's love from his former purpose to another he'd been unable to complete. He was no one's weapon now but his own, but he still felt an echo of that remorse, that nagging feeling that killing wasn't the answer, despite the calm acceptance he felt while waging war on Coda's captives. Trained for violence, remade in violence, he struggled with the concept that anything other than violence might constitute a solution to any problem. But he was willing, even in the heat of his familiar battle trance, to entertain the possibility. The crowd noise grew steadily louder as he approached the barracks, chanting, roaring, filled with mob fury. The weapons fire concentrated on him intensified too. Jump troopers equipped with jetpacks were beginning to converge on his location. He angled toward a slender tower, connected to the barracks by several high-rise accessways. When he was within leaping distance, he jumped for one of its transparent steel viewing platforms, lightsaber stabbing ahead of him. The window shattered. He rolled across the platform and came up running for the stairs. Bystanders leapt out of his path, waving their upper limbs and screaming for help. They were extravagantly dressed, and few of them were Nymordians. Humans vastly outnumbered aliens. They didn't look like Imperial officers, though. Starkiller ground his teeth together as he entered what looked like nothing so much as a casino. That was why there were so many extra ships around the Imperial compound. The Potentate was running a decidedly non-official credit-making venture on the side. He was no different from the many Starkiller had rooted out for Darth Vader while still in the service of the Empire. Venal, self-serving and cruel, they squeezed their minions with an iron grip, while at the same time currying favor from those like them higher up the chain. The Empire's well-being was no longer his concern, but the galaxy as a whole would be better off if he took another corrupt Imperial down along the way. He could hear the crowd's roar through the soles of his feet. He was close now, very close. The casino's defenses were tight, but no match for him. What he couldn't fight through, he simply destroyed. At the final juncture, he guided a Skytram off its tracks and into the side of the building, tearing a hole large enough for an army to burst through. He jumped into the maelstrom of sparks and molten metal and ran to where he could sense Coda, still fighting for his life in the Potentate's theater of death. One long straight corridor led to a double door made of durasteel. It was guarded by 6 stormtroopers. Starkiller didn't bother stopping to fight them. With a gesture, he pushed them aside, then burst open the doors. The full-throated roar of the crowd hit him hard, like a physical blow. He slowed to a walk as he passed through the door and found himself in a giant stone arena. A combat zone, painted red with blood, exactly as he'd seen in his vision. The steep sides were full of spectators, but only a handful were present in the flesh. The rest attended via hologram. Their blue flickering fists, claws, or tentacles were upraised, chanting in numerous languages at once. Starkiller didn't understand what they were saying, but he could work out the gist of it. Kill. 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 In the center of the arena, surrounded by a legion of dead and wounded assailants, was Rom Kota. One fist was wrapped tightly around the throat of a dying stormtrooper. His green lightsaber blazed as he raised it to deliver the killing blow. Starkiller felt the stirring of another memory. He'd been in such positions before, tossed into arenas and forced to kill everyone who came against him. That was for training, though. He didn't think there was anything remotely educational about this spectacle. Coda! He cried. The aging general raised his head, searching for the source of the voice over the baying of the crowd. It can't be. Starkiller ran out into the center of the arena. The crowd howled and hissed. From far above came a booming command.
Send out the Gorog!
Starkiller came to a halt in front of his second master. By the Force, Coda whispered, staring at him with eyes that no longer worked. Thanks to an injury Starkiller himself had delivered, but seemed to see regardless. His exhaustion radiated from his filthy skin like the heat of a sun. He was battered and weary and on the verge of collapse. He staggered back, looking almost drunk with fatigue.
I saw you die.
You saw me in your future, too. I did, but... A series of thudding clangs came from a vast gate on the other side of the arena, and the huge metal doors began to open. From the darkness on the other side came a vicious snarl. Starkiller turned to face the latest threat. Why don't you sit this one out, General? Coda gripped Starkiller's shoulder and bared his teeth.
Never. I've got a score to settle.
Something moved on the other side of the gates. Something heavy and bestial and very, very big. Starkiller grinned back, although he didn't know what was funny. He wanted to ask about Juno, but just then wasn't the time. You were never very good at taking orders. Out of the darkness thundered a bull rancor, roaring and spraying drool. Starkiller came forward 3 paces, putting himself squarely between the beast and Coda, feeling nothing but confidence. On Felucia, his former self had defeated just such a beast. This one, he was sure, would prove to be as significant a foe. He raised his lightsaber to strike. There was something wrong with the way it was running, though. Its eyes were wide and staring, but they weren't quite focusing on either Starkiller or Coda, and the light he saw in them wasn't fury. It was something else. Something Starkiller didn't immediately comprehend.
I don't care whether the restraints have been tested or not,
boomed the voice a second time.
Open the Gora gate now!
Starkiller recognized the voice as belonging to the potentate who had welcomed him on the landing deck, and heard another loud clang. The bull rancor glanced over its shoulder, and Starkiller realized then that it wasn't running toward him, but away from something else. The look in its eyes was fear. Through the open gate, behind the rancor, came a giant hand, attached to an arm as thick as a small cruiser. Each clawed finger was as long as a starfighter. With surprising speed, it reached out and snatched the bull rancor off the floor of the arena right in front of them and pulled it screaming back into the darkness. Something crunched, and the screams were cut off. Bones cracked and splintered with a sickening sound. Sinewy tissue stretched and tore. The crowd was utterly silent now. Not a soul moved. Starkiller backed up a step, staring up into the shadows in shock. What exactly had he just seen? Was it a hallucination? An ear-splitting roar came from the darkness, and he braced himself to find out. Chapter 4. 2 days earlier. Dax Moon, Juno very quickly discovered, was as unexciting as its name suggested. It was a gray, airless rock, tidally locked to the water world it orbited, so its backside pointed endlessly outward at the stars. Juno had spent several hours watching those stars, and the faint specks that indicated ships traveling to and from the Mon Calamari system. Waiting for the Organa operative, she was slowly beginning to believe, wasn't coming at all.
I have completed my scan of Dax traffic control,
Proxy told her.
There is no mention of a ship or ships intercepted on suspicion of anything related to the Rebel Alliance.
She irritably tapped the controls of the 2-seater R-22 Spearhead Interceptor she'd found waiting for her in the Solidarity's hangar bay. How long did she have to wait before she gave the mission up as a waste of time? She had better places to stew over her lot than the backside of this sterile dust bowl. At least, she told herself, Proxy was working properly now. The damage to his holographic camouflage systems that had frozen him in the image of his former master had been successfully repaired by R2-D2. Only occasionally now did he adopt one of his many stored templates, including Juno's. But most of the time, he was just his skinny metal self, with glowing yellow eyes and an unflinching desire to serve her. The latter was the one remaining fragment of his primary programming, given to him by his deceased master. The rest had been burned out of him by the core on Raxus Prime. 10 more minutes, she said, and that's it, princess or no princess.
Will we attempt this mission on our own, Captain Eclipse?
She'd been giving that a lot of thought. Dak won't save itself. But she wasn't Starkiller, and she didn't want to become him. All her life, she'd been part of a system. It suited her, the hierarchy of command and her place in it. Yes, she argued sometimes, and she especially didn't like being reprimanded. But on the whole, she preferred it to going alone. Nothing had made her happier than when the Rebel Alliance firmed up its command structure, with Bel Iblis providing strategic and tactical advice, Bail Organa, or his daughter, supplying access to crucial resources and intelligence, and Mon Mothma presenting the public face of the Alliance to those beings who required inspiration. The Alliance fleet didn't have a supreme commander, per se. It didn't actually have much of a fleet to speak of yet. Just a ragtag accumulation of ships. But the fact that a vacancy existed had reassured her. Someone would eventually step up to fill it. She'd been certain. And for a while, the system had worked. Orders filtered down from one commander or another, and the Alliance had held intact. Now, though, with Bail Organa absent, and something of a schism developing between Mon Mothma and those of a more military bent, including Bel Iblis, nothing was certain anymore. Who exactly did tell Juno where her duties lay? Did the leaders have to take a vote now, before making any kind of decision? If Leia Organa felt compelled not to take sides while her father was absent, what happened next time there was an emergency and the Alliance needed to act quickly? These thoughts circled endlessly through Juno's mind as she waited. It was an improvement, she supposed, over wishing Starkiller would come back to shake everyone back into line.
I have detected an approaching vessel.
Juno was instantly alert. Where? Information on the screens in front of them enabled her to locate the tiny dot in the endless starscape. It grew brighter by the second, until the blocky outlines of a cargo shuttle became identifiable. Markings on its hull identified it as belonging to a small mining company on the inward face of the moon. It had no visible weapons, no shield, and offered no explanation for its presence. As it neared the surface of the moon, the cargo hatch on its port side opened wide, revealing nothing at all within. Juno's hands rested on the R-22's controls, ready to fire or flee as circumstances demanded. Dust puffed as the cargo shuttle touched gently down. From the brightly lit interior unfolded a reticulated loading arm. It pointed once at her starfighter, then once into the shuttle's hold. Juno examined the prospect with a critical eye. We could shoot our way out of there if we had to, right? She asked Proxy.
I foresee few difficulties on that score,
said the droid.
There appears to be no armor on the inside of the shuttle, and its crew space is small.
Lucky we didn't come in a Y-wing, she muttered as she activated the starfighter's attitude controls. Oh, we'd never have fit. The arm folded back into its niche as the R-22 hovered gently across the rocky gray terrain. Juno took it as a personal challenge not to ding either vessel as she slid inside. Such maneuvers were unfamiliar to her after years of fighting combat and recon missions, and, more recently, simply telling the staff of her frigate where to go. She was pleased to feel old reflexes stirring. Guiding her hand as much by instinct as by anything her head could identify. With a gentle thud, the metal surfaces of the two ships met. The cargo shuttle's hatch slid closed. Juno took her hands off the controls and waited. When the space inside the shuttle had repressurized, a small hatch opened, and a tall human male stepped out of the crew chambers. He wore a gray-green pressure suit, minus its helmet, and could have been any one of a million unskilled cargo shufflers from anywhere across the galaxy. Only he wasn't. Juno recognized him the moment the R-22's landing lights caught his features. It was Bail Organa. The starfighter's hatch swung open above her, and he helped her out of the pilot seat. "You're a little overqualified for this, aren't you?" she said. His Serene Highness, Prince Bail Prester Organa, first chairman and viceroy of Alderaan, patted down his oil-smudged outfit.
What? Haulage?
or convincing the Dak Resistance to join the Alliance?
Maybe both.
Well, I offered you a job once, and you said you'd think about it.
You called me a pilot with a conscience, she said. I'd never work for someone with such poor judgment of character.
They grinned and shook hands. Nice to see you too, Proxy, he added as the droid unfolded from his own seat. Come on through.
So this is how you stay out of the Emperor's scopes,
Juno said as he led them into the cramped, ozone-stinking cockpit. He was the shuttle's only occupant.
Part of the time.
He tapped the outdated instrument panel with some affection. In this, I can go practically anywhere, anytime, and no one gives me a second look. Same with this. He indicated the mirror-finished helmet, hanging on a rack behind the pilot's chair. Cheaper than a cloaking device, and no messing around with stygium crystals.
Tell me about it.
Oh, yes, you've had experience with them on the Rogue Shadow. He sobered. I heard about Kota. That's terrible news. She took the co-pilot seat. It was bound to happen eventually. The man had crazy luck, but it couldn't last forever.
He made his own luck. As we're about to.
He operated the controls with the ease of recent practice, lifting the cargo shuttle off the surface of the moon with the starfighter safely inside and sending it on a long arc around to the Daklit side. Juno noted with approval that he didn't fly too well. Anyone watching would see the occasional jerk and misdirection, as they would expect from a clumsy grunt.
I presume Leia explained the situation, she said.
He nodded. We're meeting Akbar in an hour.
What's the plan?
We don't have one yet.
Where's the rendezvous point, then?
A mining colony called Sar Galva.
Sar Galva is located in the Mural Trench, said Proxy. We are not designed for aquatic environments.
No, but the Quarren are, and we need them if we're ever going to get the Dak Resistance Movement into the Alliance. Dak rose over the moon's forward horizon, a crystalline blue world streaked with high-altitude clouds. The cargo shuttle glided slowly upward until it broke free of the moon's gentle gravitational pull and began powering for the planet. This main drive was inefficient and noisy, making conversation difficult. Juno settled back into the seat, thinking over everything she'd learned about the world and its resistance movement before leaving the Solidarity. Home to numerous sentient species, although predominantly the deep ocean Quarren and the semi-aquatic Mon Calamari, Dak had a long history of conflict with the Empire. With the declaration of a new order and the beginning of the Imperial regime, their senators had been arrested and a new corrupt regime had been installed, helped by indigenous collaborators who had sabotaged Dak's planetary shield. The takeover of the shipyards and the subjugation of the native population hadn't broken the planet's spirit, however. A resistance movement had struggled on for many years, and then foundered when the Empire destroyed three of the planet's floating cities in reprisal. Since then, Quarren and Mon Calamari had squabbled more often than they'd worked together, and the Empire's grip on their homeworld remained crushingly tight. Akbar had been one of the failed resistance movement's earliest and most promising leaders. So impressive had been his fight against the Imperial forces that the officer who had eventually captured him had presented him as a trophy to the Grand Moff in charge of the occupation, who had kept him as a slave for more than a decade. Rescued in one of the Rebel Alliance's earliest coordinated attacks against the Empire, Akbar had returned to Dak to stir up revolt, and met surprising resistance. Discredited by historians, their shipyards nationalized and their leaders enslaved, the population of Dak had very nearly lost their spirit. It would take a show of strength to whip them into the proper frame of mind to retake their world. The shuttle rocked from side to side as it hit atmosphere. Organa pulled back on the throttle, allowing them to talk again.
Dak has no aerial defenses to speak of, Organa said. The planetary shields have never been repaired, and the remaining cities suffer constant bombardment. An entire fighter wing is stationed here, its mission to terrorize and to crush any signs of an air force forming. Akbar has tried, but he can't get so much as a recon droid in the air without it being shot down and his equipment destroyed. So where do the Quarren fit into this? They live underwater, not in the air. The fighter wing only patrols the air, not the oceans, and particularly not the deep trenches. By following those trenches, the Quarren can go anywhere without being seen. They can construct supply lines, establish headquarters, even build submersible launch platforms that would be less vulnerable to attack than anything on the ground. With the Quarren on our side, the Mon Calamari would have a real chance. So what's the problem? You'll see. Ahead of them, the ocean was rising up rapidly to meet them. Organa did nothing to slow their descent. All he did was tip the shuttle in order to present the smallest possible cross-section to the approaching wavetops. At the last instant, he fired the forward thrusters on full, not to stop the shuttle, but to turn the water ahead of them to steam, cushioning the impact. Even so, Juno was thrown forward against her harness. A rushing, swirling sound enfolded them, and the deck rocked beneath their feet. The main drive cut out, and the repulsors kicked in. Instead of pushing up, they pressed the shuttle down against the resistance of the water. Her ears popped as they dropped rapidly into the depths. Darkness fell outside. The shuttle's many joints and seams creaked under the rising pressure. Juno felt queasy but refused to let it show. "I'm guessing," she said, "that the plan is for the Resistance to take out the fighter wing and thereby show the locals what they're capable of."
"Spot on, Captain."
"What's the wing's designation? Would I have heard of them?"
"Quite possibly. It's the 181st. She shook her head.
"Never come across them before. Just be glad it's not the Black Eight."
"Your old command?"
"I'm sure it's gone downhill since I left," she said. "But I doubt its methods have improved." She thought of the forests of Kalos melting into black sludge and tried not to imagine what Dak would look like after such an attack. Oceans were different from forests, but the principle was the same. Where life got in the way of the Emperor's plans, its very existence was forfeit. The scope showed the hard surface of the seabed approaching. Undulating hills, punctuated by the occasional sharp spire, stretched off into the murky distance, covered with fields of thick waving weeds. Organa leveled off and headed north. They hadn't traveled far when an enormous chasm opened up before them. The Mural Trench, Juno presumed. Clinging to its side was an artificial structure that projected out over the depths. Several thick cables and pipes stretched vertically downward. What lay at the bottom, Juno couldn't tell. The scopes didn't even show a bottom.
"Welcome to Sar Galva," Organa said as he guided the shuttle to a halt near a docking tube. "This is nominally an Imperial station, but just in case."
He handed her a fake ID, which she affixed to her flight uniform. "If anyone asks, my name is Amon Ravens, your Pin Roban."
When the docking tube was empty of water and full of breathable atmosphere, they headed back to the airlock and cycled through. Juno stepped warily into the station, testing the air and finding it more than a little fishy. Literally. Sar Galva stank like an aquarium that hadn't been cleaned for a decade. Organa led the way. Proxy took up the rear. They passed a checkpoint without incident and headed deeper into the station through a maze of tubes and spherical-shaped compartments. Vast machines chugged and bubbled all around them. Juno didn't have the first idea what the station extracted from the depths. Fearing that asking might expose her as an outsider, she stayed quiet. They passed several bulging-eyed Mon Calamari. But by far, the majority of workers here were Quarren, with their tentacled faces and clawed hands. Juno didn't suffer from speciesism, as many of her old Imperial colleagues had, but she was still getting used to the variety of beings she encountered through the Alliance. Mon Calamari looked cheerfully guileless to her, while the Quarren were utterly unreadable. The language they used when talking to one another was unlike any other speech she had ever heard. She hoped the individuals she would be dealing with could at least understand Basic.
"Through here, I think,"
said Organa, waving her ahead of him into a cramped mess. "You're not sure?"
"Let's just say that down here, everything's uncertain."
The room contained a long table and several individuals. Five orange-skinned Quarren huddled in a group at the far end. Closest to them was a slender Mon Calamari, who looked up as they entered. Juno recognized him instantly from Hollows.
"Senator Organa,"
Akbar said, reaching out with one long-fingered hand.
"Thank you for coming. And you must be Captain Eclipse."
Juno returned the handshake. Akbar's skin was damp and cool, and his grip surprisingly strong.
"Don't close the door,"
he said to Proxy, who had turned to do just that.
"We're expecting someone else."
The five Quarren looked up, and he introduced them in turn as Sirik, Nosaj, Rarl, Kuvran, and Feral.
"Sirik is an underwater explosives expert," Akbar explained. "He lost his family during the destruction of the three cities. He and his assistants are keen to help in any way they can."
"We're grateful to you for meeting us here," said Organa, offering them a brisk bow. "I'm as keen to see your planet freed as you are." The Quarren exchanged a handful of short words, none of them in Basic.
"Are they always this conversational?" asked Juno.
"Don't be discouraged," said Akbar. "They are a brave and proud people, like my own, when roused."
A tenth person came into the room from behind them, and instantly the five Quarren were on their feet, bulbous eyes staring, tentacles waving and fingers pointing. They tongue-spat and snarled in their alien tongue, as much at Akbar as to the new arrival, who was another Quarren, as impenetrable as the rest.
"This was a mistake,"
this one said, in heavily accented Basic.
"I knew I should not have come. Stay, Sigor, stay."
Akbar put a hand on the Quarren's arm and turned to the others.
"He's here at my invitation,"
he told the others.
"Don't you think I have as much to be angry about as you?"
An uneasy silence fell. Juno studied the dynamic closely as the newcomer eased farther into the room and Akbar encouraged everyone to sit with him at the table. He introduced the people who didn't know one another in a matter-of-fact way, downplaying the dramatics with his brisk, no-nonsense tone. Juno felt some of the tension ebb, even though it was never remotely close to vanishing. When it was Segor Tel's turn to be introduced, he offered a brief explanation regarding his fellow's outrage.
"A young fool I once was. A fool who thought my enemy's enemy must be my friend. It was I who sabotaged our world's planetary shields, resulting in our home's occupation and my people's enslavement. In the many years since, I have learned to regret that action, and to understand that my kind is not alone in its persecution. We must put aside our differences and work together to reclaim our world. We must stand together."
He addressed them with a conviction that spoke more of necessity than real commitment. But Juno admired the attempt. in the face of years of animosity between his species and the Mon Calamari, plus the very personal antagonism displayed by Sirik and the others, he was bravely standing his ground, when it would have been much easier simply to go into hiding and never emerge.
"We're here to help you," she said. "If you let us."
Sirik said something in the Quarren tongue, which Tells translated.
"He says you're only here to help yourselves. You care about starships, not the oceans or the people who live on them.
The right of all beings to live freely and in peace," said Organa, "is what the Rebel Alliance cares about. Ships will help us, yes, but that's not our primary objective in coming here. We need leaders and soldiers. We need people who will spread the word. We need translators and medics and all manner of specialty. What we need most of all, though, is to know that the people we're fighting for are behind us. We're risking our lives, and the lives of our families, every time we so much as speak out against the Emperor. Forgive us if we ask for a little commitment in return." Organa's expression was severe, and Juno could tell that he was thinking of more than himself. Now that the Emperor knew he was a traitor, Leia was in constant jeopardy. Only a constant pretense of innocence and compliance had saved her thus far. That, and the fact that even the Emperor balked at murdering such a well-known and well-liked young woman. Tells translated Senator Organa's words, and some of the aggression left the five. Sirik looked down at his hands, which were splayed out in front of him. Juno noticed that two of his digits were missing from his right hand. Explosives expert, she remembered, and wondered what efforts he'd already made to repel the Empire from his world.
"The 181st Fighter Wing is based in Hyorkia,"
Akbar went on, producing a data pad and displaying images as he spoke. The first was a map of the Southern Territorial Zone, with the floating city appropriately marked.
"We can approach from the east, behind the cover of Mesta Reef. The 181st patrols every 3 standard hours in groups of 2, with a 10-minute overlap. But there's a period once every 5 days when all the pilots are recalled for debriefing. That can last anything up to an hour. The next such briefing is in 6 hours.
Sirik said something in his native tongue.
"I know we have no air force,"
Akbar said.
"Ask yourself what a frontal assault would achieve. Reinforcements would arrive within hours, and any advantage we gained would be quickly reversed. And more, the Empire does not take kindly to insurrection."
"As we know all too well," said Tells.
"You've got something else in mind," said Juno, relieved she wasn't going to be asked to mount a single-handed assault on the fighter wing, and thinking of Sirik's missing fingers. Akbar outlined the essence of the plan in a few brief sentences, and Juno learned why his mind had been so highly prized by the Grand Moff, who had made him a slave. The plan was within their means, yet certain to have a far-reaching effect on the Imperial forces in the region. If it succeeded, they were bound to galvanize the resistance into a single force. If it failed, no one would ever know.
"I like it," she said. "Count me in."
"And I,"
said Tells. All eyes turned to Sirik and his assistants, who conferred in a series of hurried whispers. Sirik asked Tells a question, and he translated it for the benefit of Juno and Bail Organa.
"Sirik wishes to know how he can be sure that he can trust you."
"He can't," said Akbar. "He can only take as a form of assurance the fact that I will be fighting alongside him."
"We all go down together, in other words," Juno said.
or we all give up and go home. The Quarren conferred again, and this time they agreed. 5 nods indicated their willingness to be part of the mission.
Thank you, Akbar said. We will never forget your decision today.
Neither will the Rebel Alliance, said Organa. He glanced at his chrono. 6 hours, you said, Akbar? If we're going to make that window, we'd better get started.
You're coming with us?
Juno asked him.
Of course. I didn't come here just to make introductions and pretty speeches.
But you're not trained for this kind of work. I wouldn't want to answer to your daughter if you were killed.
Don't worry about that, Captain Eclipse,
he said with an expression that was part smile, part grimace. I think you'll find that I can handle myself.
Juno didn't press.
Organa's experiences with the Emperor stretched farther back even than the formation of the Empire itself. No one lasted that long on luck alone, she supposed. Akbar stood and, with a powerful sense of gravitas, shook hands with Segor Telz. Only then did the mission truly get underway. Chapter 5. Present Day. Starkiller stared up in awe at the massive beast that emerged from the shadows. All muscle and bone and teeth and claws, it walked with a hunched, thundering gait that made the stone beneath him shake. Its thick, powerful legs looked disproportionately small compared with the reach of its arms. But the strength they contained, capable of propping up a creature larger than most spacecraft and actually propelling it too, was almost beyond comprehension. Were it to raise itself upright, its hands would brush the arena's distant ceiling. Thick duranium shackles that pierced its dense flesh down its back prevented it from coming any farther than the center of the arena. It strained against the chains, roaring. One mighty fist lunged forward to take out its frustration on the tiny creatures standing before it, with their bright blades raised in futile defiance. Starkiller went one way, Kota the other. The stone cracked beneath them. Dust and splinters of rock flew like shrapnel. Starkiller rolled on landing, then jumped again as the Gorog groped after him. It missed by barely a meter, amazingly fast for a creature so large. He slashed at it, but although his blades parted the red-black skin, he couldn't cut deep enough to do any real damage. He was going to have to fight the Gorog some other way.
You're a Jedi, said Kota from his memory. Size means nothing to you.
The Gorog's heavy domed head swung to its left, looking for the general. Starkiller drew its gaze back to him, pushing through the force at its nearest foot. It barely moved, but the effort didn't go unnoticed. Keeping its center of gravity low and stable probably took much of the creature's resting energy. So the last thing it would want was to be nudged off balance in the middle of a fight. Whether it reasoned consciously or simply reacted by instinct, Starkiller didn't care. He definitely had its attention now. Both fists came for him, converging with enough force to crack a moon in two. He stood his ground, adding his defiant shout to the creature's angry roaring. The fists came together, making Starkiller's world shake. But he went unharmed behind the strongest force barrier he could muster. When the fists lifted, he found himself buried almost a meter deep in a gravel pit of shattered rock. The Gorog stared down at him in slow-witted surprise. He took the opportunity to leap onto one of its arms and run along it all the way up to its mountainous right shoulder. It swiveled from side to side, trying to track him, and scratched blindly at its back. The heavy chains clanked and rattled. Starkiller leapt onto one of the anchors that bit deep into the creature's flesh and braced himself against the filth-stained metal. His arms could barely reach from one side to the other. Starkiller took a moment to concentrate, and then poured a powerful stream of lightning through the thick metal teeth, directly into the rippling muscle tissue. The Gorog flailed and roared. It rose up and up, until the surface Starkiller was clinging to became very nearly vertical. He ceased shocking it, and climbed from anchor to anchor, heading for its head. Its hands groped blindly, swinging the chains from side to side. He dodged claws longer than his entire body, and leapt, finally, onto the great bald skull. A metal plate sealed shut a massive rent in the skull, where some genetic defect or wound had left its brain exposed. He didn't know if it could feel him yet, but he didn't doubt that it would soon. Raising both lightsabers blade down, he stabbed deep into the metal plate and ran forward, melting a double line downward toward its hideous face. At the same time, he shocked it with lightning, using the plate and his lightsabers to conduct the electricity directly to the creature's giant neurons. The Gorog's fury doubled. The head whipped from side to side with a great grinding of vertebra and sinew. Huge ropes of spittle splashed from its slavering mouth. The sound of its roars was deafening at such close range. Starkiller leapt onto one of its thick plated eyebrows and clung tight to a branch-like hair with one hand. The other pointed down into the creature's nearest eye, ready to send a shock along its optic nerve right into its brain. The eye rolled, fixed him in its black stare. The pupil tightened. It had seen him. Before Starkiller could move, one mighty hand came from behind him and with the force of a mass drive cannon, swept him from his precarious perch. For a moment he was both weightless and stunned. The world turned around him, and he thought he heard Juno saying, "Have you done this before?" And himself responding, "Trust me, I'm doing the right thing for both of us." Then, he hit the stadium, and only a force barrier reflex, honed by thousands of hours of punishing training, stopped him from breaking every bone in his body. His senses only slowly returned. Holograms flickered and sparked around him as he climbed groggily to his feet. He was halfway about the side of the arena, surrounded by spectators from afar, chanting for one side or the other. Starkiller wondered if it mattered to them exactly who was fighting, and why. The promise of violence was all they cared about. Well, he could give them that. The Gorog hadn't given up on him either. It had broken half of its chains during its frenzied writhing, and it pulled free of the rest to follow him into the seating. The few spectators who hadn't already fled Starkiller's vicinity now did so, fearing what might come next. The stadium's walls shuddered as the huge creature applied its full weight to them. Starkiller took a moment to look for Coda. The old man was neither lying squashed on the arena floor, nor foolishly rushing in to help, and both relieved him. He needed Coda alive, if he was going to find Juno soon. And he didn't want to be distracted by keeping the old man that way. But he didn't want to lose him either. A quick search through the force revealed him to be climbing upward through the stands, slashing at anyone who stood in his way. Settling that score he'd mentioned, Starkiller assumed. Then, there wasn't time to ponder the matter any further. The Gorog approached, dark blood running down from the gash in its scalp and dripping into its gaping mouth. The taste seemed to enrage it. One arm swept across the stands, destroying hologram generators and snapping pillars by the dozen. Starkiller ran in the opposite direction. Someone was shouting orders from the skybox above, but he didn't pay any notice. The creature followed him around the stadium, making it shake and reel. A huge slab of stone, dislodged by one of its wild grabs, came down just in front of him. Starkiller leapt higher, to the very top of the stands. There he found a ramp, along which the very last of the spectators